Welcome back to Stacktrace, your weekly podcast about iOS development, the world of Apple and technology and beyond, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great here. How are you?
I am doing really great. You know, I've been thinking that all great products, they turn into verbs eventually, right? Like Google is now Googling, like the act of using Google. Do you think that there would be any way that we could turn Stacktrace into a verb? So the act of listening to Stacktrace would be Stacktracing? You think the cool kids would go around saying that, you know, I've just been Stacktracing here earlier?
I think that's a great idea. And actually, fun fact here, that's one of my favorite features of English, is that you can turn anything into a verb. Basically,
it is a great feature.
Yeah,
I believe it was added in version 1.59 in the year 1632.
Where are the release notes? Awesome. So, John, what have you been up to? Are we having another edition of John's Swift UI Gaming Corner thingy?
Of course. Nice. Step into my gaming corner here, like it's me in my corner. I'm not feeling ashamed in the corner. I'm feeling pretty happy in the corner. Doing my game development over here. And just like on the previous editions of this little mini segment on the show, I want to talk about something that is more like a general topic, but something that I've encountered and been working with while I've been developing this new game that I'm working on. And that's designing UIs, or rather how to add an element of granular disclosure when designing UIs. So the game that I'm working on is a turn-based strategy game, and it basically works where you have this grid system where you can have buildings and characters on the board, just like kind of a chessboard, and you move them around. But when we were designing the graphics, my friends who did all the graphics for the game, they wanted to make the graphics look more organic than just kind of a square grid, because that, you know, in terms of chess or something, like one of these classic games, it kind of looks very clean and iconic. Mm-hmm. But in terms of a game like this, it would look kind of stale, or it would look a little bit like artificial, right? You want to make the game look a little bit more organic, a little bit more fun, make the levels look like actual places, not just game levels, right? Yeah. But the challenge with that then is that when you're playing the game, you want to get a good sense of the grid system when you're, for example, moving your units. So when you're moving a character from, you know, one square to another, you want to really get a good overview of the squares, because that's the only way you can really plan your moves and you can know, you know, am I going to step into my enemy's attack range here, or how far is it to this particular point, and so on and so forth. So that led me to a lot of prototyping, and I started kind of adding a grid to the UI so that you could see the grid system at all times when you're playing the game, like adding lines basically to show the grid. But that really went against that philosophy that I talked about earlier, that we wanted the game to look and feel like nice and organic. So that didn't feel right to like expose that kind of grid. It almost felt like exposing an implementation detail of the game, right? Yeah. But at the same time, I wanted to have that utility in the user interface, you know, and that's something that I feel like we often have to strike when we're working on apps as well, is balancing kind of aesthetics and utility and not cluttering up the screen too much, but also adding enough controls and showcasing the controls so that the UI becomes intuitive. So the balance that I ended up striking, what I think is a pretty good balance, is that I don't show the grid at all times, but when you select a character to move it, the grid will highlight around you so that you can see the tiles that you can move to, and within those tiles, I am drawing the grid. And again, we can put a link and an image in the chapter art so that you can see exactly how this looks like in action. But what do you think about the solution, Rambo, of like kind of gradually disclosing the details of the app or the game in this case in the user interface like this?
I think that's a really good approach. I think it's called progressive disclosure, right?
Right, exactly.
It's when, yeah, you slowly let the user in on the details of how something works. It could be an app, it could be a game. And I think games in particular are really good at it, because usually you start with the first level and it's super easy and there's a little tutorial showing you how to do things. And the difficulty increases slowly, and as it increases, the game teaches you about other abilities your character might have. So maybe you start out with just a sword, and then later you get like a hammer or some sort of other type of weapon that's more complicated to use. And in most games, you don't like start out with every feature your character can have. You slowly get those as you move along. And it's not just because the game wants to keep you engaged and keep you playing so you can achieve those goals, but also because if you start out with every single possible feature of the game, then it's too complicated and you might be driven away from it. So I think games are a really good implementation of progressive disclosure in user interfaces.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of by necessity because a game really needs you to have fun playing it, right? It can't feel too overwhelming or too complicated because users are just not going to want to play the game then. But I also think that's extremely relevant when we're designing our own apps as well, because apps these days, especially more kind of powerful productivity tools, they have usually a lot of features. Kind of like you mentioned, you have, instead of different weapons or different abilities in your character, you have maybe different tools or you have different features in the app. And if you show all of those things, if you kind of just drop the user in the middle of your app without any explanation, that can also feel kind of daunting and too complicated, and the user can end up, you know, uninstalling the app or not really utilizing it to its full potential because it just feels too overwhelming. But at the same time, a common solution to this problem is, let me put up a tutorial, like an onboarding experience that walks you through everything very guided. And games sometimes do that too. They have like a very rigid tutorial that you have to follow, and you just have to like move your character here, click here, then click here. And I don't know how you feel about these things, but I usually think that those are very boring and I tend to skip them. And that's kind of a shame because then I'm also skipping learning about the app. So I think the best games that do this, you know, the best very well, is that they integrate the tutorial into the game itself. Like you mentioned, like the way they let you progress in the game or unlock new abilities as you play. That way you don't need that explicit tutorial in the beginning showing everything in a very guided way, but you can rather, yeah, progressively disclose it and progressively discover it as a user as you play. And I think you can do the same thing in an app as well, where instead of just saying, let me teach you everything about this app now here in this onboarding experience, instead, maybe let me guide you slightly when you are in that particular context. So for example, if you are opening up some kind of editor view, you could start showing like, did you know that you could copy this thing over here? Or did you know that you could use this tool? And perhaps also if users do something that is kind of an anti-pattern in the app. For example, let's say your app supports a duplicate feature, but your users are copy and pasting. Then you could show a little pop-up saying, hey, did you know that you could also duplicate so that you don't have to perform these duplicate actions over and over? So there are many different ways to do it, but I just found it interesting when I'm working on these games that, you know, these kind of challenges present themselves and I'm kind of forced to think about them in different ways.
You mentioning the app giving those tips to the user instantly reminded me of Clippy.
Yeah, Clippy, I think, is the like original implementation of that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I am not against onboarding, especially in apps. I think some apps can benefit from that. And especially if your app requires some sort of permission from the user, like location or something, like it wouldn't work without that or wouldn't be useful, then I think it's worth having a little explanation and teaching the user about that. And also, I see many people complaining about onboarding screens in apps these days. But the real reason why pretty much every single app in existence has at least one onboarding step these days is because of GDPR. And you are required to show the privacy policy link before the user can start using the app. And the only way to do that is to have an onboarding screen. So yeah, you can thank the EU for that.
Right. And I also want to clarify that I'm not saying get rid of all your onboarding screens, not at all. And I'm also not saying go ahead and build Clippy. I'm not saying either of those two extremes. I'm just saying that I think in this case, like I mentioned in this game and in also several apps that I worked on, I've just found it really valuable and interesting to try to contextualize some of those onboarding tutorials and tips when the user needs them rather than always showing everything up front, right? But of course, don't be too annoying and don't be too like, let me help you, because that can just turn into something repetitive and users just don't want to see it anymore, right? So striking a balance is often key, and also here.
Yeah, apps and games that try to tutorialize everything, if that's even a word. Yet another feature of English. There you go.
Right.
So when they do that, it's kind of like when you walk into a store and you just want to browse around and check out stuff. And there's always like a salesperson like, what do you want? Can I help you? What are you looking for? Oh, this is this product. Why did you look at this other product? And then you're like, I just want to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of similar to that. It's the virtual salesperson.
Yeah, and it's a lot about having kind of taste or having the sense of putting yourself in the user's shoes, right? And not just thinking as the person who wants to convey this message or who wants you to enable push notification or sign up for the newsletter or whatever action you want the users to take, to try to think about how will this look like from a user's perspective, right? Not just how does it look like from the business perspective or the developer's perspective. So yeah, I think balance is key, of course. But it's also good, I think, to have these different tools in your toolbox and to think about these things in different terms, not just one or the other. So, yeah, that was my little game development story this week. But nice. Now I want to hear about Air Buddy 2, and I want to enter Rambo's Air Buddy corner.
I've been very happy with the beta process. I released 4 betas so far, closed tens of issues. And the new feedback system has been working really well. I've received over 150 reports, which doesn't mean that like it's because the app is super buggy, but it's really like good reports and most of them minor little issues. And that's why running a beta process is so good, because you find these little things that then you won't find when these people are actually customers who have paid for the app, which becomes a whole other issue when that's the case. So with beta testers, it's a lot more easy because it's mostly just a back and forth of, oh, send me these log files and what's your machine? And you triage the bugs and figure out where they go. There's lots of duplicates as well. Like when there's an issue, most times it's not just one single beta tester, so you end up getting more than one issue. And I don't have like an automated duplicate detection or anything like that. I am the duplicate detection. So yeah, it's been going great. But I did have, I mentioned last week, I didn't have any major issues or any crash or anything like that. I think I mentioned it to you on iMessage that there were basically no crashes at all, except for a known one, which is in a subcomponent of the app, which is not Swift, which is interesting. But anyway, there's this issue that had to do with app translocation. Have you heard about it, John?
I don't think so. What is that?
So app translocation is a security feature of macOS. I am not sure when exactly it was introduced, but I think it's been going on since High Sierra. And it's one of those security features which is basically undocumented. Like, I found very little to no information about it. And what's even worse about the lack of documentation is that it's not even documented when it goes into effect. So let me tell you what happened before I knew what app translocation was. So I was getting, I got like 2 or maybe 3 reports from beta testers, and this is from over 1,000 beta testers, so it's a small number of users, but still like from 1,000, it's significant. And the issue was usually something that appeared as, oh, the app is not working, which is one of those generic issues that in the case of Airbuddy, when you first launch the app, it installs a helper process, which is what does all the work. So the app itself is just the settings window. And from these people's reports, I was able to gather crash logs, because my suspicion was that the helper process was crashing on launch and then it didn't do anything. So I got those crash reports. And I don't remember exactly what the crash report said, but it didn't have like any specific error or something. but there was an observation in the crash report. It was like, note, translocated process or something like that. And the launch path for the process, it wasn't like slash user slash somebody slash downloads or slash application slash everybody. It was like slash var slash temp slash folders xyz 123, like one some random path.
That's when you know you have a really fun bug, when you get a path like that.
Yeah, and then my first reaction was like, let me check back with the user and see, like, did they download this using some weird download manager and it put the app in a temporary folder? And nope, it wasn't that. They just downloaded the app and tried to run it. And then I started digging and I asked for help in a Slack group here, which I participate, which is of Mac people. And then they taught me all about app translocation, except that pretty much no one knew exactly when it goes into effect. But the gist of it is that, let's say I download an app from Safari, for instance, and I unzip the zip file it comes in, and I don't move it anywhere, and then I double-click the app in my downloads folder. It's going to show me the little, this app was downloaded from the internet, yada, yada, and then you click OK, it launches, but it's not launching from the downloads folder.
Hmm, interesting. Yeah, I've actually always been wondering about how all that works, and the whole deal where you have to move the app to the applications folder, and some apps they won't launch unless they are in the applications folder. I've always found that to be somewhat confusing, even like decades later of using macOS. And so this is going to be really interesting to hear what is going on here.
Yeah, so it's really complicated because, okay, so app translocation only goes into effect when the app is quarantined. So the quarantine flag is an extended attribute of the file system, which is set when you download an app. And that's what triggers the little, this app was downloaded from the internet dialog. So AirBuddy.app, which you download, it was downloaded from the internet. Once you click OK in that dialog, it's not quarantined anymore because you have, as the user, given it permission to launch. And what happens when you click OK is that the quarantine flag is removed from the app. But AirBuddy Helper, which is a completely separate bundle, which is embedded in the main app bundle, but launched separately using a launch the property list, that's not unquarantined.
Right, and that's because it is in the downloads folder, right?
Exactly. So when launch services would launch the helper process, it would translocate the AirBuddy helper process, but it would translocate the helper process without all of the rest of the bundle, which is around it, which contains things such as the shared frameworks that are used by both the main app and the helper process. So the crash log was something like library missing. It was missing one of the frameworks. But it took me like a week to find out what was going on. And what I had to do was use some APIs from the security framework, which let me know that the app is currently translocated. And I do this on the main app. So when the main app is launched, if it's translocated, I will unquarantine the helper app from the main app myself so that it's not translocated anymore. That was like, not fun, but interesting nonetheless.
Could another solution have been, this is probably not something that you wanted to do, but could a solution have been to say, if the app is being run, for example, outside of the applications folder or specifically within the downloads folder, to present a dialogue and say, you know, you need to move this before running it or something like that?
I had done that already. What happened when you encountered a translocation in that process was that it would enter an infinite loop of to move itself, because it would look at the launch path and it would never be the applications folder because the app was translocated. And the only way for app translocation to be cleared for an app, at least that I know of, And this depends on OS version. This is not documented at all, so I'm probably saying a lot of wrong things here. But the only way for it to not be translocated is if the user clicks and drags the app in Finder from some folder to another folder. So like from the downloads folder to the applications folder. So me moving the app itself from within the app would not work. Yeah, so I had to do, basically this happens, the code I had to include in there happens before NS application main, and it does all of the work to unquarantine everything and make sure that it's not translocated anymore. And then after NS application main, so within the app, normal app code, then it has the little, it's called, it, everyone uses this, is like an ancient library. It's called Let's Move. And it basically does what you mentioned. If you're not launching from the applications folder, it offers you to, hey, would you like to move me to move myself to the applications folder? And then it works. But what a pain.
Hearing this entire story here just makes me so excited to soon launch my game on the Mac. Well, to be fair, I'm not running background processes and things like that, right? It's a little bit more straightforward than what you're doing. And it just goes to show, like, once you dive deep into like the operating system and the file system and all these things that you're doing with AirBuddy and calling private APIs, there's like that, you know, here be dragons thing, right? Like you're running into issues like this, especially undocumented behaviors. But that was really interesting to hear also, because I bet we have some listeners who have once or twice tried to like launch an app outside of the applications folder, for example, within downloads, and it hasn't worked. And maybe this actually would be an explanation for why.
Yeah, and ideally apps would just work, trademark, if you launch them from like whatever, if you want to launch them from the desktop, they should work. But unfortunately, there are lots of reasons why that's not always feasible. So yeah. And in the case of AirBuddy, the really boring explanation is that it registers Mac services, and for Mac services to be registered, the app must be launched with a launchd property list. So I can't just like move it to the launch at login items in the like the user settings. That wouldn't work. So that's the basic explanation.
Right. Oh yeah. Low level programming is sometimes really fun, but sometimes it has downsides as well.
Absolutely.
Cool. So after a visit to those two corners, my game development corner and your AirBuddy corner, let's now move into the wider corner of the world. Well, nice segue, right? The
perfect
tech corner of the world, by talking about what's been going on in the news. And like always, there are simply too many news stories for us to cover here, and we'd like to just pick a few to comment on real quick. And the first one is a very quick one, Rambo, right? And that's that iOS 13.7 has been released today.
Yes. Can we just take a moment to appreciate the number 13.7?
Like, yeah, it's not common that iOS versions, like minor versions, go up to 7, right?
I think it's a first in history, actually. I'm not sure about that.
Well, iOS 13 kind of started on 13.1, right? So it was already ahead when it launched.
Ahead of the curve. So yeah, 13.7 was released today. It had been released last week as a GM to the developer beta feed of iOS 13. But today it's out for all users. And it's what they call Exposure Notifications Express, which sounds really cool. And it basically allows public health authorities to just send a configuration file to Apple or Google and they don't need to set up a custom app in order to be able to use exposure notifications. So that's really cool.
That's very cool. And I really hope that this now will really cause a lot of governments around the world to adopt this so that we can, you know, get this pandemic under control, or at least get more data around it, and without requiring any specific app to be installed. And I really hope that all these governments who have tried now to, you know, hack the Bluetooth stack and do their custom own solution that won't really work very well, at least not on iOS. I really hope that people will just now take the opportunity to use this system because it works across both iOS and Android. And now you don't even have to write an app for it. So yeah, I don't feel like there are many more excuses, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is really good. And Yeah, we'll see what the adoption is going to look like. Fortunately, my country already has an app, so I've been using that and haven't had any encounters with anyone so far. At least it hasn't alerted me to any.
Right. Yeah, that's like the push notifications that you really don't want to get.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. So next up, we have a interesting report from Bloomberg, and it's kind of like a summary report. Mark Gurman typically does these before the fall each year, where he kind of sets the expectations for what we might see from Apple during the fall. So Rambo, do you want to be our chief summarizer and tell us a little bit about what is Mark Gurman suspecting that Apple might be launching this fall?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, he's summarizing here the rumors for this year, which, as we know, like, Gurman is usually correct with his predictions. So I think this is a good overview of what we should expect to see. So for iPhones to, quote, low-end and to high-end iPhones, also, the long-rumored HomePod Mini, which is, like, it's been rumored for a long time. AirTag, yay. And also a new Apple Watch. I think that's all, right?
Yeah, and there was also a couple of comments around what to expect around 5G for the iPhone, right? Yeah. And it looks like we are getting 5G iPhones this year. What do you think about that? Like, are you excited about 5G, or do you feel like, you know, it's not very exciting for you? Or how do you feel around incrementing the integer of our networking technology?
I care as much about 5G as I care about, I don't know, something I don't care about. I really, really don't care at all about 5G. So it's not going to be here where I live for the longest time, probably. And yeah, I just really don't see a use for it. Like, LTE is so fast. I've never, like, when I do have good LTE signal, the main problem I have with mobile networking is not that it's slow, it's that the coverage is usually rough. Like, you go to some place and all you get is 3G, or you get 4G and it's just one bar and it's slow. So the problem is not that it's the technology is slow, it's that the coverage is bad. So you're too far away from a cell tower, and then it's slow. But I don't think 5G is aiming to solve that, right?
Yeah, that's a complicated thing, because usually when you increase the speed of these networks, these mobile networks, you have to also make the range shorter, right? That's kind of how it works in terms of the frequencies. And you know, I'm not an expert around these things by any means, but you know, it kind of, it's like how Wi-Fi is way faster than 3G or 4G, but it also has a more limited range, right? And that's also why Wi-Fi gets stopped by walls. It all has to do with the kind of amplitude of the waveforms and things like that, like details that neither of us are experts in. But it's interesting, though, because with mobile networking, with every kind of generational shift, I have been really excited about that. Like, when I was using 2G networking and it went to 3G, that was a huge shift, right? And when I got my first, like, the iPhone 3G, and it was just so much faster, I was just so happy about that. I could actually do real things with the internet on the go. And then with 4G, even more so. And now, like, it's almost like the internet is an implementation detail. Like, everywhere I go, I have fast internet, at least, like, you know, where I live and most of the places I've been traveling, not this year, but other years. So I kind of feel the same way about 5G. It's like, I'm sure it's going to get good in the future, and I'm sure we're going to see a difference and it's going to be faster, but it doesn't feel like something that I'm just like, I can't wait for it because the current networking is so slow. I really don't feel that way, which is kind of also a testament to how far we've come in that regard.
Yeah, definitely. And just want to give a disclaimer here, because I do have some Brazilian friends who listen to the podcast. I know that my iPhone was not purchased here, so it has some difference as to which 4G and LTE bands it supports. But I have tried local devices, and side by side, I didn't notice any difference in coverage. Because every time I mention that I have bad coverage, people say, oh, it's because you bought your iPhone in the US, but it's not.
Right. A couple of other products also mentioned in this report here by Mark and Debbie Wu is a new iPad Air with an edge-to-edge iPad Pro-like screen, and also the over-the-ear headphones that we've been expecting, like the AirPod Studio or something like that. I'm really excited about these things as well, just to see what they're doing with these products, and also the Apple Watch as well, just to see, you know, will there be any really big new hardware features? For example, something to do with like blood analysis or something like that has been rumored, which could be really cool as well.
It will take x-rays.
Right, exactly. It will be like a super scientific device that you can use to take x-rays of your own bones as you're wearing it. I don't know how useful that will be, but anyway.
It will be definitely cool. But I'm super excited about the AirPod Studio, obviously, because anything to do with Apple or Beats and headphones or earbuds or whatever is always interesting. By the way, I've adopted the name headsets to describe all of those products, because headphones are one thing, earbuds are another thing, so I just use headsets.
Cool. Yeah, I guess that's a good term, but headsets also is, you can use that to refer to phones as well, right?
Yeah, but you can't be perfect, right?
That's true. Yeah, there's always some ambiguity somewhere.
Exactly. So going back to iPhones, which I think it's what people are mostly interested in, we are seeing here in this report that apparently the replacement for the iPhone 11, so let's call it the iPhone 12, would be available in both a 5.4-inch and a 6.1-inch display. And the 12 Pro, which we'll call it that, it's probably going to be 12 Pro, will be 6.1-inch or 6.7, which, wow.
It feels like if we forward the time now, like 20 years in the future, that phones will be like 15 inches or something, like the way that they're growing. It feels like they just keep getting larger.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to ask your opinion on this, because when I first saw this, I was a little bit disappointed, because I really like the size of the current iPhone 11 Pro, so the non-max one. And which is basically the same as the iPhone X, it's just a little bit thicker and heavier. But like when I hold an iPhone X in my hands, it still feels way more comfortable than this phone, just because the 11 Pro is a little bit thicker and heavier. And also in this report, it's mentioning that maybe the LiDAR sensor will only be in like the max version. And don't make me buy like this huge phone just because I want LiDAR. Like, it's not going to be comfortable. I used to be a large phone person, and I had the 7 Plus and the 7, what was the names? The 10S Max, right? the Apple keeps changing the names. So, yeah, whatever the large one was before the 11 Pro. But yeah, I really like the current size, so I'm a little bit disappointed that it's going to be larger.
It does depend a little bit on what the actual shape will be as well, and especially what the thickness will be. Mm-hmm. Because imagine if some of these rumors that we've been hearing throughout the year are true, that it will adopt a more kind of iPad Pro-like design or iPhone 4-like design, which, you know, is kind of similar to the latest iPad Pro models, where it will have more kind of sharp corners and be thinner. If that happens and the overall weight of the device can be decreased because of that, then adding a couple of like 0.5 inches, I don't think that would be maybe such a big deal, because the current iPhone 10 and 10S and 11 Pro, so many different models to keep in my head now, they are 5.8 inches, right? So imagine if also the devices would get thinner and lighter and maybe have a little bit more like tight design. I think that could work for something like 6.1. Of course, I would also prefer to keep the current size, I think, but that's something that I feel like I always say. Like when the iPhone 6 came out, I was like, oh, do I have to get a bigger phone? I like my iPhone 5. And then, you know, the same thing happened over and over again as the phones have grown, like I joked about earlier. They really have. So yeah, I think I'm probably going to get a new iPhone this year, because I'm still rocking the iPhone 10. So I think it's time for an upgrade. And going to 6.1 with those kind of design tweaks, I think, would be fine for me.
Yeah. And by the way, another disclaimer, because I know people are going to say this, I know I don't need the new iPhone. Like, I'm not going to be forced to buy the larger iPhone. But you know me, I like having the latest and greatest, and it's going to have new features that I really like, and I'm probably going to want to develop against some new hardware that they release, so I am going to get the new one, of course. So that's why it bums me out a little bit that it's going to be larger, but I'm sure I'll get used to it.
Something also that could be playing into if the LiDAR sensor is only available on the Macs, it could not just be a matter of kind of upselling people to the larger phone, it could also just be a matter of technology shrinking, right? Where the current only product that has the LiDAR sensor is the iPad Pro, which is much, much larger than an iPhone. So it could just be something where they just couldn't fit it into the smaller ones.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Physics, it's a thing.
Yeah, like we talked about on the previous episode, like the limits of physics is now like the biggest enemy for companies designing hardware, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So next up, let's now move into our deep dive segment. And on this episode, we want to take a deep dive into creating an app clip, because that's something that you've recently done, Rambo. So we now are going to go behind the scenes, behind the new Chibi Studio app clip that you've been working on. And so you can tell us a little bit about what the experience was creating it, some of the challenges involved, and how you ultimately overcame them. So first of all, could you just do a quick recap around what app clips are and kind of what a developer needs to do in order to support them?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, app clips are mini apps. So widgets are not mini apps. Remember that, the new widgets on iOS 14. But app clips, they are, in fact, like mini apps. The main limitation being that they can't be over 10 megabytes in size. But basically, let's say you have a specific feature within your app which could be used by itself, either to provide value to users or even as a way to showcase your app to prospect users so that they then install the full app after trying it out. So that's the use case for app clips. And they can be activated in several different ways. So they can be activated by tapping a link in iOS. They can also be activated by scanning a QR code or by reading a NFC tag.
Exactly. And that presents some really interesting opportunities around both, like you say, showing or letting the user use a given feature within an app. But I'm also thinking that this might be used as a way to implement kind of trials of apps, if you will, or maybe something like an interactive trailer or interactive demo of an app where you get limited access to some of the app's features. You can get to try them, but you can't use the full extent of them. And then when you download the app, you get access to the full set. But just to kind of give users a little bit of a way to get a taste for what the app can do.
Yeah, and this is also a great thing to be used by apps, which are sometimes required to perform some sort of task. But there's no point in the user leaving the app installed. So like if you need an app for a parking lot or something, or you need an app for a shopping mall or an airport or a payment provider which offers some sort of cashback or something that user wants to try out, but they don't want to necessarily install an app. And there are many of these things which are already using NFC tags or QR codes as triggers. And it's a matter of substituting those with the triggers that will trigger the app clip instead of directing the user to the app store or some website. So I think there are lots of use cases. And the one that Apple really highlighted during their demos was the payment use case. So if you have an app that has lots of partners and they can pay within the app to the partner, and it's not necessarily something the user wants to keep on their device at all times, they can just scan a QR code or tap an NFC tag and pay using your app, and they can log in using signing with Apple, and they can use Apple Pay or your own payment solution, and they pay and that's it. And if they like the experience, they can then download your full app afterwards. So I think it's a really cool thing, and we'll see what the adoption is going to look like. But I have a feeling that the iOS developer community is more excited about new stuff like this than other developer communities in general. Of course, there are the flops like the iMessage App Store, this could very well be another one of them. But I think there's a good chance this is going to be adopted. And another thing I forgot to mention is that they can also be triggered by a physical location. So when you go to provide your app clip to Apple, you can tell them that this app clip code is relevant in this particular geographical location, and it can be surfaced in maps and things like that.
Right. So app clips are really interesting, but that part that you mentioned there with the companies using this to implement apps that are essentially kind of throwaway apps, mm-hmm. where you use it to perform a given task and then it just gets discarded. I'm a little bit skeptical, to be honest, around what the adoption will be for that particular use case. Because if you think about it, I think most app vendors and most companies, even companies that make apps for parking meters or payments, want users to keep the app installed, and they want to be able to send them push notifications, and they want to, you know, enable them to reuse the app and to, you know, discover it, that they have it installed and use it somehow to show them some offers.
Track the user.
Right. So, and also another thing around that is that, as I think we're going to dive deeper into now when you explain the process of converting Chibi Studio into an app clip, it requires a fair amount of work, I think, for quite a lot of apps, because 10 megabytes might sound like a lot, but if you look at the average size of your average app on the App Store, and I'm not talking about games, I'm not talking about things that have a lot of assets and graphics and sounds, I'm just talking about an average app, they tend to be quite large with a lot of different libraries inside of them and a lot of different...
tracking.
With a lot of different libraries inside of them, with tracking, with lots of different things that go into this app, right? So combine those two things where the companies might actually be actively against the fact that their app will just be discarded and they need to do a lot of work to support this. That just leads me to be just a little bit skeptical. I hope it will happen because I think it's a cool idea, but I'm a little bit skeptical around what the actual adoption will be.
Yes, we've had this discussion before, I think, in one of the episodes right after WWDC, so I'm not going to rehash the whole thing here, but just to give my counter argument, which is the same I gave back then, I think you underestimate how hard it is to make users install an app, even if it's free.
Right.
It's really, really hard to get users to install an app. And I see an app clip as like having one foot in the door. Like,
right,
you,
yeah.
If you get your code running on the user's device, even if it's an app clip with all of its limitations, I think after the user has done that little step, which is really easy and really quick, I think it's a lot more easy to make them install your app, especially given that Apple is incentivizing developers to do that, and there's also official API you can call that shows like an offer for the user to install your full app. So I think the fact that it's hard and it's becoming harder lately to make users install an app, I think that's going to drive adoption for app clips, but of course I could be wrong.
That's why I think it makes sense to look at this more like from the angle of a trial, right? Of a user getting a trial or just a taste for what the app can do, rather than looking at them as kind of throwaway apps, right? Because no one wants to build a throwaway app,
exactly.
But someone might be interested in building a trial. And in fact, when we were talking about app clips, I was also thinking, maybe I should try to build something for my game where you could send someone a link and they could play like a couple of turns with you or something. But then I looked at my graphics folder and just the graphics folder is like 30 megabytes. So I think it's going to be hard to shrink the game down to 10 megabytes. It would be a fun challenge though. But I do still like the idea, even though, like I mentioned, I'm a little bit skeptical around what the wider adoption will be, especially for that specific use case, like parking meters and payments and stuff. But you also do bring up a good point around, you know, getting users to actually install something from you. But I'm still excited about the concept at large. So now let's actually talk about the technical aspect. So I mentioned that for me, shrinking that like large graphics folder into something smaller might be close to impossible or at least really difficult. But even for your app, and you also do bundle a fair amount of assets as well, but you did have to do quite a lot of work to shrink your app, as I've understood it. So can you walk our listeners through the process of, you know, from the moment where you first built the app as an app clip, what did it look like in terms of the app size, and what did you need to do to bring it down below 10 megabytes?
Yeah, absolutely. So Chibi Studio packs a lot of assets, like you mentioned. And this is an important point. It's become like a meme to like shame apps for being large. And it's something I'm not necessarily against, but you have to look at it on an app-by-app basis. There are many, many, many apps in the App Store that are like 300 megabytes, and you look at them and it's basically all tracking frameworks, all like third-party code or something. But in the case of Chibi Studio, it is large for a good reason, because it includes a lot of cool assets that the user can play with. And I explained this in my article, which we'll leave a link, of course, that since the beginning, it's been like one of the philosophies we have with the app, that we don't want the app to require an internet connection at all. So we want the user to download the app and they can leave the app downloaded and launch it during a flight or something. And remember flights? They can play with the app. And we have actually received good reviews in the App Store because of that. Like, oh, I really like this app because I can play around with it on a plane or something, and I don't need to be connected to use it. So it is something that's valuable to us, and that's why we still opt to ship every single asset for every single item pack within the app without requiring a download or on-demand resources or anything like that. So just to get that out of the way. And the full inventory, I don't remember the exact size, but it's like it's close to 100 megabytes. It's lots and lots of assets. And of course, I knew we wouldn't be able to fit the whole thing in there, because 100 megabytes, like, it can't be compressed to 5 megabytes or something. Of course, many of those packs are premium ones, which you have to purchase as an in-app purchase in order to be able to use. And there are no in-app purchases in App Clips, so of course, those would all have to be removed. But even after removing all of the premium stuff, it was still like 50 megabytes in size. So then I asked my friend who does the app with me, who does all of the graphics, pick like one or two of the free packs and create a smaller version, like remove any items which look too similar to another one, because there are some items which have like a few variations. So like it's not like a big loss. So remove any items you think you can and you think are not particularly necessary. And so he did that. And after doing that, and I compiled both packs, they were still over 12 megabytes. So that wasn't good. I still need it needs to be under 10, and I need space for all of the code and stuff like that. So then we ship with the packs. Each item is two assets in an asset catalog. The actual vector data, core animation archive for the asset, which is used when you're working on the canvas. So that's the actual item itself. And another item in the asset catalog, which is a little preview PNG for the item, which is what shows up in the item drawer. So I looked at that and I thought maybe I could remove the previews from this reduced size pack and render those on the fly for the item drawer in the app clip. I had tried to do that before, I think in the first version of the app, but it was too slow. iPhones were slower back then in 2016. But trying that out now, I don't know if maybe I got better, so I know how to write faster rendering code or something, or if it's the iPhone or both, but it's a lot faster these days. So I was able to safely remove the previews from the app clip, and that brought down the size a lot. Like it was about 5 megabytes, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the technique that you mentioned there is I think, very important one in this context, and that's to programmatically generate resources, because that's something that you can do, because you can then write them to disk and cache them, or you can store them just in memory if that's something that you could do. And that's actually also a technique that is very commonly used in game development. And I've worked on some games where, for example, I wanted to show like a grid of all the levels, like a scroll view, and I didn't want to include an image showing the level. So I wanted to actually generate it, just like you mentioned, from the level data. But I didn't want to do that as the user was scrolling, because that would cause, especially on older devices, really, really horrible performance. So what I ended up doing was, when the app is first launched, I kick off like a background dispatch queue, and I start processing these level data in the background, and I save images like PNGs to disk, and then I go ahead and load those images when the user goes to that particular screen. And then you might end up with a race condition if you do something like that, where what if the user goes to the screen before? But I actually did also handle that case, and I then showed like a placeholder and then filled that in once the data became available. So you can do some tricks like that around either like deriving your resources from existing resources, like in your case, using the vector data to generate the preview, or you could do it completely in code programmatically, or you could download it from the internet. Like, there are different approaches you can take here to generate kind of on-demand resources in a way that doesn't require you to bundle it in the app itself.
Yeah, and this is nowadays, like, it's a very simple process, because it's just, John, taking a CA layer and rendering it to an image context, and then getting that image as a UI image. So it's a fairly straightforward process, but of course you have to do some dispatch stuff in there to be able to do that in the background, and there's some CA transaction stuff you need to do if you don't want the system to yell at you that you're dealing with CA layers in the background. So there is some stuff in there, but it's mainly just like work. Like, it's not like super complicated or anything. It's just like you have to do it, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was fun. And also another thing I did was to adopt LZMA compression for the actual vector data, because I was using, since the first version of the app, I was using gzip to actually zip up the vector data to make it smaller within the app. And I tried out the LZMA algorithm using the Apple compression framework, and it makes significantly smaller output than the gzip algorithm. So, and I didn't notice any performance implications, so I adopted that one. And that was also really good at reducing the size of my assets.
It's really interesting, because you mentioned here at the beginning of the segment that you couldn't just compress it, right? And it would just work. But compression did end up playing a part in shrinking your app size. And I think that's a very important point here as well, is you typically need to employ different technologies in order to achieve something like this. You can't just find this one solution that will just work for everything. You need to do a combination of different tasks, like, you know, programmatic resources and compression and stripping out things that are not essential to the app experience and so on. So that's just really interesting to hear how you needed to kind of do a combination of all these different things to make this happen.
Yeah, definitely. And this also had a benefit for the main app, because when I did the LZMA compression for every single pack in the whole inventory, I managed to reduce the entire inventory from 127 megabytes to 78 megabytes. So it was a huge gain.
Yeah, and that's great also for the production app as well, right? Not just for the app clip.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to benefit every user of the app going forward. So we talked about reducing the size of my assets, which could or could not be a part of most app clip work, depending on what type of work you're doing. But I think Chibi Studio is a little bit of an outlier in this space. Or maybe your game would also be one, like, which is very asset heavy. But I think what takes a lot of space in most apps these days is actually the code, right?
Yeah.
And we tend to think like, oh, it's just code, right?
It's just code. Just ones and zeros.
Yeah, how big can it be? And turns out quite big, especially if you're talking about Swift. It still tends to produce larger binaries than if you work with Objective-C. But it's not like I'm going to rewrite Chibi Studio in Objective-C just to get a smaller binary. I don't think that's a good idea. So I had to do some work as well in terms of, since I'm sharing a lot of code with the main app through my existing frameworks, I had to basically take a framework which was basically the entire app UI was in that framework. I had to, and just UI, not the actual core, like asset management and things like that. And I had to actually split that up into multiple frameworks. So basically what ended up happening is I took like the base UI stuff, which is required by everything. So like color definitions, extensions on UI view and UI view controller, basic like buttons and reusable components. And I put those into their own framework, and I linked the previous huge framework to this base framework and removed, of course, all of the stuff from it. And then the actual editor, so the canvas experience, which is what I wanted to include in the app clip, also became its own framework. And it now depends on this base UI framework only, but it doesn't depend on the other big UI framework, which has basically the entire rest of the app in it. And that's how I managed to squeeze another like 2 megabytes of code out of the app clip.
Nice. Modularization saves the day again. So one typical problem that you can encounter when you start doing something like that, like you want to pull a part of a framework out into its own separate framework, you end up getting a lot of compiler errors because some code within that part that you pulled out is referencing another part of the framework. And then you almost end up like bringing the whole rest of the framework with you anyway, because you just need those symbols. Like maybe it's different convenience APIs, maybe it's different types that you need to use, and so on and so forth. Which of course maybe also is a sign that you didn't factor your code properly and you didn't separate concerns enough, because everything kind of depends on everything. So it's kind of the classic spaghetti code scenario. So did that happen to you? Did you also have to kind of untangle some spaghetti as you were modularizing in this way?
Yeah, I did have to do a little bit of that. I had to introduce some protocols and things like that in order for different systems to communicate with each other, because they were coupled before, but they couldn't be now. I think, fortunately, the UI part of the app is, this UI code is the most recent code in the app, so it's a little bit more like written with the mindset of being a little bit more isolated and using dependency injection and things like that. So I think I avoided a lot of problems, but the first attempted build after I did the split, I will never forget that Xcode showed me 255 errors.
Right. And then you have to kind of use that as your to-do list to kind of just, you know, get all those errors resolved and so you can move on.
Yeah. And of course, there weren't 255 errors. There were more. But don't you think 255 is a special number of sorts?
Maybe. Did you get that error, which is too many compiler errors aborting or something? Like, that's when Xcode gives up on you. It just says, you have too many errors. I'm just going to call it quits.
Exactly. So 200, turns out 255 is the limit.
Nice. It's a good limit to discover.
Yeah. So basically what I did to avoid what you mentioned of ending up like moving the entire framework over to the other framework, which wouldn't have been of much use, I thought about it conceptually, like, is this a base thing or is this something that's specific? Like, is this a final implementation of something that's concrete, or is this something that other things are built on top of? That was my approach. So anything that was there so that other things could be built on top of it were moved to this base framework, and everything that was specific to the canvas experience was moved into the canvas framework. And in the article I've written, there's a diagram of the architecture, including all modules, and one before the app clip and one after the app clip, which I think can be a good way to understand what the difference is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one way to cut it as well would be to say, I'm going to now move all my non-domain specific UI code out to a component library, for example. And regardless of app clips, I think that's in general a pretty good approach to have like your very core set of UI components that are not specific to any particular data or domain. Like, they're not called, for example, user cell or user view. They're called more like text view or image view or something. I mean, those are perhaps even more base components that ship as part of the system, but you have these components that are not related to any particular feature. And typically in any average app, you have a fair amount of those, more than you might initially think. And it's kind of neat to have those clearly separated from the rest of the app, where you can have a complete guarantee as well from a kind of architectural perspective that these views are not aware of any particular models because they literally don't have access to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people want to try out the app clip, it's available on TestFlight, and the link is in that article we're going to link in the show notes. And it's very nice that the TestFlight has been updated, and when you submit an app to TestFlight, you can register test links that users can use to try out your app clip. So when you go to the app on TestFlight, there's a list of the app clips, and in the case of Chibi Studio, there's only one. And then you tap test, and it will, if you have the app installed, it's actually going to remove the app and install the app clip and launch the app clip for you. That's quite cool. And if you want to try something cool out about the app clip, if you make a chibi in the app clip and then you install the full app and you launch the full app, the chibi you've created in the app clip is going to be in your library in the full app.
That's super cool. And that's kind of the final thing I wanted to ask you. Was there anything you needed to do in terms of your implementation to support app clips? Like, did you need to change any of your, for example, networking or file IO code? And how did you implement that kind of continuation between the app clip and the main app?
There was one thing I had to do, which was to allow my app to have CloudKit disabled. And what I mean by that is not even like instantiate a CK container, which is the CloudKit container class, because app clips can't use CloudKit. I'm not sure about the public database, but definitely they can't use the private database. So CloudKit is out of the question for app clips. And since that's the case, I didn't even include the CloudKit entitlement in my app clip, of course, because if I did, and then Apple would reject it because, oh, it's using the CloudKit entitlement, but it doesn't use CloudKit, and you know how it goes.
Right.
And then basically what I had to do was adapt one of the classes in the library code that basically was instantiating a CK container at like app launch, because it was like a let, and basically I had to make that an optional, but I did it in a way that didn't affect any call sites or anything like that. But that was mainly what I had to do. Of course, whenever you're dealing with shared library code that's going to run under multiple targets, you have to think about entitlements and also like privacy keys in the info.plist. So if you use the camera, you have to remember to add like the camera usage description to your app clips info.plist as well. And the same goes for any type of permission you need. And to be able to do the continuation you mentioned, what I did is I used the shared app group. So very simply, whenever you change your chibi in the app clip, and I have a little bit of a debouncing there to not be doing this every millisecond or something, it's going to save that out to the file system. So it's saving it in the shared app group container. And then when you install the app, the first thing it does when it instantiates the library is it checks if that file is there, and if it is, it imports that chibi to your library.
Cool. And I said that my previous question was the final one, but this is really the final one here. This is a super interesting topic, and we could go on and on for, I think, a few more hours just talking about app clips, but we'll probably return to this topic on future episodes too, of course. But that is, now that you've had a chance to build an app clip and actually use this model that Apple chose to implement this, or to, you know, model this API for us developers, what do you think about it? Like, because they could have gone different routes. They could have said, you can mark like a slice of your app as your app clip, but you would still use the same app code. They could have said implement it as an extension and so on and so forth. So what do you think about the decision to make it as like a mini app and use the same kind of infrastructure as a quote unquote normal app? And yeah, what's your overall kind of takeaway from doing this work and building this app clip?
I think they did the right thing because from the perspective of a developer who's not used to dealing with lots of multiple targets and extensions and things like that, which I think is still the case for most iOS developers and also even some companies which have iOS apps, doing an app clip is kind of like doing a mini app, and you don't need to share code using frameworks like I did. In fact, for app clips, I would say the benefits are not that big, actually. If you already have an app and you are not using frameworks, I wouldn't say you're going to benefit from using frameworks in terms of your app clip. I think it's beneficial for other reasons, which we talked about before. But for app clips specifically, you could probably just check the files into the app clip target as well. And it will probably work just fine. And in fact, that's what Apple suggests, like in the sessions and things like that. Because, of course, they want to give a simple example. But if you're already using frameworks, then I don't see a reason why not go that through that approach for app clips. But yeah, I think they did the right thing. I would say if I had to complain about something, it would be the 10 megabyte size, because like 10 megabytes is really, really small for an app these days, even if it's just like a small portion or just one feature from your app, it's still quite a challenge. And I think it is going to be the biggest challenge for most app developers. It's going to be meeting that 10 megabyte limit. And I wouldn't be surprised if they raised that limit in the near future, because it's just changing a flag on the back end, John. Just change the flag and to 15 megabytes. It would have saved me hours.
Right. Just please, Apple, flip that switch. Like, give us 15 at least, or maybe 25. If they do end up giving us 25, then I think I would be able to make my game work. But 10, it's probably too little. But also, that's what happened with the App Store in general, right? Like, I remember the first couple of apps that I was shipping on the App Store, I had to really work hard to bring them down under the limit where you could download them over mobile networks, which was also something like 10 in the beginning, and then it was like 25, 50, and now I don't even know what it is.
I think it's like 200.
Right, exactly. So it's really large now, and I'm sure something like that will happen. Maybe with 5G, Rambo. Maybe that's what we're going to use 5G for, to download our app clips.
Oh, that now I see a news for 5G.
Now we're excited about it. All right, so hope you enjoyed this deep dive. It was really interesting to hear your story there, Rambo, of how you implemented this app clip. So hope you all out there, all our wonderful listeners, enjoy this segment and this episode in general. If you did, please feel free to share our show with a friend or on Twitter or something like that. That's always really fun for us to see when people share our podcast. Or just send us any feedback you want our way. That's also really appreciated. But regardless, thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.